Welcome to Matters of Experience, the podcast where we dive into the ideas, innovations, and imagination shaping the world of designed experiences. From museums to multimedia, from architecture to AI, we explore how creativity transforms space into story. If you're joining us for the first time, we're so glad you're here. And to our regular listeners, thank you for coming back and being part of the conversation. If you enjoy what you hear today, please take a moment to rate the show and share with a friend. It helps curious minds find us. So welcome, I'm Abigail Honor.
Hello everyone, this is Brenda Cowan.
Today's episode is a conversation with Lucy Holmes, founder of Home Studio in London. She is a designer and creative leader who has spent over 30 years working with the arts and cultural sector. Lucy is no stranger to the US because she started her design journey at RISD. And for those who aren't familiar with that, it's Rhode Island School of Design, where she fell in love with graphic design as a way of seeing things, as a way of life. She moved back to Old Blighty, and after working at some top companies like Pentagram, she made the fearless move to set up her own company. Lots of things to talk about that with you, Lucy, putting people at the heart of her thinking. Her recent projects include working with the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, the Natural History Museum of Denmark, the Science Museum London, the London Museum and the British Museum. So basically, if you're headed to London for fun or professionally and wander into a museum, chances are it's one of hers. She's also a multiple award winner from professional bodies, including DNAD, DBA, ISTD and SEGD. And I'm not going to spell out all of those. Look them up. But she's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, which for everyone who doesn't know, makes her very special. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's very nice to be here and to have the opportunity to talk to you both.
So, Lucy, you and I were introduced by Sabelle Jones, who a lot of people know is the CEO of SEGD. And we're enjoying a lunch at the River Cafe, designed by Richard Rogers. I know one of your favourites who sort of designed a lot of that Thames Wharf there. And you told me this lovely story about being at school studying and that sort of light bulb moment when you fell in love with typography. Can you tell us about this passion, you know, how it started off and sort of leading you to the Guardian story? Because I think what resonated with me is passion that we have as designers for sometimes everyday things and how they can be elevated to art.
At the time, you know, the different disciplines within what we do weren't really given names. If you weren't going to be an artist, you were kind of a bit lost. And I was very interested in typography, weirdly, as someone who's dyslexic. Maybe I had to scrutinize letters more than other people. But studying typography at RISD, where we were hand-drawing letters, and we were hand-drawing alphabets and then sentences, and really understanding the relationship between one letter and another. And it wasn't formulaic, it was artistic. You know, an E in Bodoni to a T is an upper and lower case. It's every single formula was a different problem to kind of solve and understand. One of our teachers, a guy called Doug Scott, who worked at WGBH in Boston, had come back from London with the new redesign of The Guardian in 1988 by David Hillman from Pentagram. And we were looking at full pages of letters. And I realized that actually with white or off-white paper and black letters, you were creating these sort of compositions of gray with the motivation of legibility, energy, pace on a broadsheet. And that for me was the moment where I thought, this is what I'm meant to do and this is what I love. So it kind of grew, everything's grown from that.
I love hearing about your experience with working with your hands. In my design program at FIT, we have students developing ideas and doing design work by hand as well. We do a lot of hand sketching, prototype building with paper and tape, basically getting off the computer as much as possible. And what I find is that designers are freer in their thinking, maybe more willing to iterate at times, maybe more willing to make mistakes. And mostly I find that working with our hands enables us to reach certain insights. And it sounds like that was perhaps part of your experience. You know, when you kind of skip these days straight ahead to digital tools, you can lose that tactile feedback that you get and that sort of ability to mess around with trial and error. Can you tell us a little bit more about working with your hands with type? Is this something that you still do? Do you or do the folks who that you work with, do they still work with their hands? Do you still do hand sketching? What does that part of the process look like?
Yeah, I mean, often, I mean, I've got tracing paper on my desk in front of me where I've been sketching with a Sharpie.
Perfect.
We do draw. We often get out rolls of tracing paper. Sometimes it's drawing directly onto an iPad. But I think for myself and the team, it's a place where we're free.
Mm-hmm.
We, of course, at this point in our careers, we're well versed in using the technology. And I think particularly when we're working with either one word or a collection of letters in a museum project, that I will always print things out, turn them upside down, stick them on the wall, because it's more difficult than anything is to put one letter or one word on a wall in a museum is one of the most frightening things. And, you know, the relationship between those letters and how that's made. And if the letters are going to be lit or if they're going to be three-dimensional, you know, every single thing changes that dynamic and the relationship between those letters.
Can you just explain why you turn it upside down to folks who may not know why you do that?
Well, we were taught that at RISD. One is that you're not reading the word, that you're actually looking at the relationship and the dynamic of the letter forms. You know, you're trying to create an energy and the idea that this letter just looks absolutely right. I think the first time I ever did that was putting a word on a wall at Tate Modern. And, you know, the scale of things, the visibility of something, all of those things are, you know, if it's upper and lower case, it becomes even more difficult. Caps is much, much easier because you're dealing with straight lines.
Do you feel like this is a lot like maybe if I could say classical music is the highest evolution of music in some ways, you need to be educated to fully appreciate it. The level that you're talking about, typefaces, fonts, art, basically, you are so sensitive and the emotions that you're conveying are based on all of these different things. Do most people not notice?
Well, the idea that I have is that when you're working in a museum with what we do, which can often be a permanent gallery, we're trying to ultimately make our work as invisible as possible because the object is the piece. It has to be intuitively read without people even realizing they're doing it. And that means that it's got to be timeless, but it's also got to understand its place, I think.
Yeah. And also, Abby, I don't know, I'm thinking about what you had to say about classical music, and I went right to jazz. And I kept thinking, you know, I'm thinking about all of the incredible classically trained musicians who are just alive when they play jazz music. So we'll have to talk about that another day. Chalk it up for another fight.
But to come back to the music analogy, you know, when you're putting graphics throughout a museum, it's all about rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, simplistic things like where room numbers should go, they should always be in exactly the same place so that very quickly a visitor just knows that the angle of their head at this particular point, they're going to catch that bit of information. And I think then that's a kind of rhythm, and that tends to be often to be wayfinding elements.
And I think that also echoes what we're doing when we're building and designing these museums and these spaces. It's all for me about that rhythm, that music. Where are people, emotional music, where are they feeling challenged? Where are they at the height of their emotion and where can they relax and take repose? So it's the ebbs and flows like in a piece of music, and the same with the content, even the timing of the content. Where do they spend more time? Where do they spend less time? It's amazing to me how much what we design in the 3D space is very much like music. And when it works really well, it's like phenomenal. And the work you're talking about, when you think about wayfinding and museum design and the media that we create, it all has to come together.
Mm-hmm.
Passion. You're passionate about what you do. I think being passionate about your work is super important. It sort of affects how you do your work. It's, for me, it's like this little nagging feeling or pressure or like, no, it's not quite right. You've got to get it quite right. It's like going the extra mile.
Design is not entirely formulaic or scientific necessarily. It's got visceral qualities. In some ways, it's innate. And you feel and you respond as you do design to design. And I understand that you've got a story along these lines with the V&A.
Yes, we were very lucky when I was part of a different business called Homeswood. And in 2002, a designer, amazing client designer called Moira Gemmell, wanted the V&A in South Kensington for the first time to have a comprehensive wayfinding scheme. And for those who don't know the V&A in South Kensington, it is, I think, five buildings that were never intended to connect. It's 7.5 miles over seven levels.
Wow.
And it was a really enormous task, and it was an incredible project, and we had an incredible client. But we were wanting to introduce threshold banners between each gallery to very simply announce that you were in a particular zone or theme of the collection, and that you were in a named gallery. And every aperture between every gallery was different. We kept trying to apply a mathematical formula. If they're 150 mil, I'm not going to go there with inches, you know, from the edge, and we would then do it. They didn't feel right. So in the end, we decided that the only way to do it was to actually go in the space. So we drew each aperture in Illustrator, printed every single one of them out, and I went and sat in the V&A on a chair or stool in each one, and I drew with a pencil what felt right when I was sitting in that space. And then we translated that digitally, and that became the mathematics for the banners that we introduced, which was magic, you know. And it was a collective decision between us and all of us in our team of, like, every time we did it, it just didn't feel right. And so, yeah, it was a fun exercise.
Was it nerve-wracking?
Very early mornings, sort of 7 o'clock, sitting.
Oh God.
In the V&A. Well, I had to do it when it was closed.
Was it nerve-wracking, Lucy, when you do that and you haven't got the backup of, we've done it 150 millimeters, when you lose that and it's, we've done it just on feel? Is it nerve-wracking a bit to, like you said, make sure you got it right? I know you felt like it wasn't working when you're doing it the scientific way, but, you know, you've got to have a bit of gumption to be like, we're doing it this way.
Well, I was part of a great team, and we had a great client who we had kind of had a quite quickly created a sense of trust between us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we prototyped these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into some very, very challenging spaces and would install, you know, mock-ups to make absolutely sure.
Yeah.
But so it was complete partnership, collaboration. But I'd never done anything like that before or since, actually.
So I know we've been chatting also, as we're not spring chickens, about this word experience. And, you know, when we were younger, we didn't, or at least I wasn't, a bit frustrated with everyone saying, you'll understand when you have experience, or wait till you have experience. I was like, you don't want to get this thing experience. Didn't really understand what they meant. And obviously now I do. So what does sort of experience mean for you, Lucy?
Well, I think, like you, when I started out and you're 20-something and people keep saying, well, can you prove you've done it before? Of course you can't prove you've done it before. And you just keep showing up and hoping that you make some good decisions, and then, a year's gone by or whatever. What's interesting now is I kind of sometimes feel like I'm pulling my experience around like a ball and chain. Because you sometimes feel like you've got too much. And I think that's an interesting, I suppose, shift as we get older to what is the right view and thoughts and opinions that I can bring into any meeting. I think there's nothing worse than, you know, sounding like, well, in my day, or, you know, all of those kind of things. It's more about being patient. I think there's quite a lot of negative side to experience now I've sort of got some of it. And I think it's making sure that, particularly for younger designers and people that we're working with, to make sure that they have the freedom for their moment in time to get their experience, and that our responsibility now is to enable them in the same way. I was very well supported by particularly the team I was in at Pentagram in London.
I wanted to play off that a little bit. I know that through your work with SCGD, you make a point of giving back to students. You participate in providing scholarships. What is it that is important in that for you? Why do you go out of your way to support emerging designers in this industry?
I think we have the best job. I want to share my love of it. But I also, you know, by being around younger designers, and I have the most phenomenal team, I learn far more from them, I think, than they learn from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I've had incredible teachers and mentors. David Hillman was an incredibly generous boss and mentor. And so you just want to kind of continue that tradition, I think.
And it also leads me to think about your team itself and diversity within the team, diversity of all the things that we know that means, but also the way that you approach design. So how have you composed your team? You know, when you're interviewing them, how do you make sure that you have people who will challenge in the best possible way each other to evolve to the design that's right for the project? And how do you guide them? Because you're the boss. So the boss always has the final word.
I think trust is probably the most important aspect of that. I feel like my responsibility is to make sure that we all work in a space that is safe. Safe meaning there's no bad ideas. As long as we all sort of show up and are engaged and are present, you know, anything is possible. Yes, I am the boss, but I don't feel like I necessarily, I mean, there are times, but I think that we as a group are a democracy. I think because of things like the powers of 10, where we work with a huge amount of rigor to make sure that our process, we, you know, we go through a process by going through the stages that we define in a process. We make sure that we don't miss something. And if I think if you have that rigor, it creates that safety play, that place for play, because we're making sure we haven't missed something. We didn't not speak to the right person. We haven't, you know, we spent enough time in the space, whatever it might be. It's about trust. And we have to, we want our clients to trust us. We want to have that kind of open relationship. So I think everything's about a dialogue and a relationship. One of the other things is within that, that we haven't talked about, but is, you know, when do we say no?
Mm-hmm. That was one of our questions.
Perfect segue to our next question. Keep going, Lucy.
How does one say no, and why say no?
I think I try to make sure that at the beginning of a project that we've interrogated the brief together to make sure that we all understand, even like a glossary of terms, this word might mean that to you, but what does it mean to me?
Mm-hmm.
We try to, in that first kind of stage of discovery, to make sure that at the end of that process, we've kind of articulated exactly what we're trying to do. And then that's something that we can refer back to. So we can build on that and we can pivot and deviate as we go. You know, in a museum, we're trying to design the right feeling. And sometimes it can start to feel wrong. And I think that's where we can say, hang on a sec, you know, weren't we all trying to do this? So if this is what we're still aligned to, then the direction we're going in isn't the right one.
Right. And you've had to do that on projects, right? Like you've got into a project and had to sort of address that and maybe backtrack or pivot, or like you've had to do that with clients.
Yeah, well, I think it's part of the job. I mean, I don't see it as a bad negative moment. I think it's part of our responsibility to listen, to explore what we're being asked, but then go back and say, look, we really feel like this is the wrong direction. When we were doing a gallery project a few years ago, and we'd been given a very clear brief and we designed a concept in response to that. We then had done a second concept, probably quite opposite to what we had been asked to do in the brief. And I said in the meeting, I guess my moment here is if I don't show you, we don't know, but I'm about to show you something that you absolutely haven't asked for. That was the concept that got signed off.
Wow.
It wasn't done to be, you know, rebellious or kind of provocative. It was done because actually the more we thought about the conversations that we've been having with these curators about this opportunity, that this was the right way to go.
Fascinating. Fantastic.
Yeah. And I think that situation, and maybe it circles back to kind of everything, is show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
Know by the work, by your response, by your attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's nothing worse than telling.
Mm-hmm.
But if you show why,
yeah,
Right. I want to take a tiny pivot, actually, and something that stood out to me when learning a little bit about your firm is the fact that you are a B Corp, or you're certified as a B Corp. And this was an area that, as I was digging into it a little bit, I thought was of huge importance. And I wanted to take a moment to talk about, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your decision to become a B Corp and what that actually means in terms of your practice.
So it's about a 2-year process. You know, this studio I started in 2019, having left the previous one, taken a little bit of time off and thinking about what I wanted to do next. I think part of that thinking was, you know, I didn't want to do what I'd done before. So which parts of myself could I leave behind? And what did I want to do going forward? B Corp is about businesses coming together to be a force for good and not necessarily waiting for government to do that. And I feel like, in a way, some of it felt very natural, because I think as designers, particularly in public buildings, and our public galleries in the UK are free, that we have an enormous responsibility to our general public. So it felt like for a long time, we'd been thinking, whichever teams I'd been working in, we'd been thinking about people and their feelings and making sure that, you know, we take responsibility on their day off and they've gone to a museum, that they have a nice time, they can find the way out, you know, all of those things. So it felt quite natural. And it also felt, with everything that's going on in our world, that actually we should do something more than just design briefs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a really brilliant experience. And one of my team, Claire, took responsibility for driving us through that process. And it feels like a really nice community to be a part of.
Well, I think it's absolutely so important what you're doing there. And I just love knowing that there's the possibility for a firm to join a community of this sort and to really shape, again, a strong ethos and to carry it forward through the work that you do.
I guess my final question,
mm-hmm.
at least for now, is, so do you say that you design to change the future? What does that mean in practice, or what does that mean for you?
As part of the B Corp?
Yeah.
We design quite often, not all the time, but one of the big projects that we do in spaces is permanent galleries. In the lead up to this, I went to the V&A last week to visit galleries that opened that I worked on for 6 years. The Medieval Renaissance Galleries in the V&A, which is 10 new galleries that opened in 2009. And I went and walked around. And what was really lovely about being there again, that nothing's changed from what we installed in 2009. We didn't know the world that we would be in now in 2009. We were working on the galleries from 2004. But we're trying to think about now and people, but not trying to project. And we're currently working on some galleries for the new London Museum that open next year. But those galleries will probably be in place for 30 years. So we're scrutinizing, you know, we can't be thinking about technology, but what we can be thinking about is people and storytelling and what we know now to try and tell stories. You know, they're historical galleries. So we're telling stories about the past, but they're going to be in our future.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, absolutely. It's truly inspiring. Like, listening to you talk about what you do and your passion is like, I hope everybody listening takes something from what you're saying, because what everybody's making is for the future. That's one of the things I love about what we do, is it will affect people year after year after year. And the responsibility, as you mentioned, it is huge. We're creating memories for people. And I think, like, what better job in the world is there than this that we all do?
Absolutely.
I was going to say, let's end on, what would you say to the young people listening? Inspiring words would you tell them?
I think, you know, get away from your desk. Get off your technology. Go and walk around and watch people and engage with people, and people watch and see how they interact with, if it's a museum, objects, and why they sit in front of something for ages, or why they cry, or why they giggle, or, you know, watch people meet other people in a gallery. When you work in museums, we're part of the makeup of that happening. And I think the privilege of working in museums is that we're custodians for the moment, but they're not ours. This is for the people and our place.
Well, you can completely right. And I love the way you think about it. It's not about the design and the stories you're telling necessarily. It's how it resonates with the visitor, with the audience. And it's the response. That's what we're looking for. We're looking to connect and communicate. And obviously, Lucy, in your work, you've been incredibly successful. I mean, you're working on some huge projects. And I just want to sort of thank you so much for joining the show today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful.
It's been a true pleasure.
Right. Yeah. So thanks. Thanks, Lucy. And thanks to everyone who tuned in today. If you like what you heard, subscribe for more episodes of Matters of Experience wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure to leave a rating and a review and share with a friend. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you, Lucy, so much.
Thank you.
Matters of Experience is produced by Lorem Ipsum Corp and recorded at Hangar Studios. Tune in next time for more fun discussions about experience design.